Hi, thanks for joining me on the Boise Art Scene podcast. My name's Morgan McCullum. I'm here with Danny Avery, here to talk a little bit about his art and what gets him going and what the stuff he's creating. So thank you for joining me here.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. It's been great.
I wanted to find out what is your primary medium? I know you do a variety of things, but do you have one that you consider your main?
Yeah, it's been an interesting process over the last year or so for me regarding that, because I would say normally my primary medium has been acrylic paint or working in graphite pencil, but I've tried to stretch myself more recently. Like, I jumped into oil painting for about a year now, and it's like the vibrancy that I'm getting from the paint. I also wanted to be able to open up my options for my customers' commissions, to be able to go, hey, if I want an oil painting, I'm like, hey, I can do that. I'd be more than happy to get that taken care of for you. So yeah, I would say the acrylic is still my primary, but oil is like becoming a close second. And then I always have a passion towards like pencil drawing and graphite and charcoal, because my illustrative pursuits really were hardcore based in comic books.
Okay.
I'm a 90s kid. I, you know, grew up during the era of the collector's era. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, illustrators like Jim Lee and Todd McFarlane and Greg Capullo, like these comic gods to me, I always thought it was magical that they could create these things. And so I started to pursue that pretty heavily. Like, I wanted to be a comic book penciler.
Oh, okay. Yeah. My only experience with that is from like the movie Mallrats, or was it Mallrats. Where he's like an inker or whatever it was.
Yeah, it's totally. Well, you know, Kevin Smith, it's funny because he's a really interesting cat to listen to, especially since in his movies he's always so quiet.
Oh, sure.
You know, but in real life he seems like a gigantic talker. But yeah, Mallrats was that, and then he had that Chasing Amy. I think Ben Affleck's character was a comic illustrator.
Maybe that's the one that I'm thinking of. Yeah. I remember there was one of those Jay and Silent Bob movies where there was somebody who was, they would make fun of him for being a tracer or something.
Oh, yeah.
Because he was an inker or something.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and that's always been an interesting thing too. So you know, I initially pursued that pretty avidly. Like, I didn't realize like how well-rounded of an artist you need to be in order to do that. I think it's actually one of the hardest illustrative careers to pursue as a comic artist, because you have to be excellent with your anatomy, buildings, perspective, and then on top of that, you're a director. Like, where are you going to put the camera? Mm-hmm. And what's the pacing of the story? And then, like, you have to be a fashion designer. What's everyone going to be wearing? Then you're dealing with like lighting, you know, principal photography, all those kind of things. And you initially just think, oh, I'm just going to paint pretty pictures or draw pretty pictures. And so that really drove me initially, and still like it's something that I would like to go back to eventually because of the challenges that are associated with storytelling and a panel to panel level. And it really equipped me to be a productive artist, to be able to really churn around my paintings. Because my understanding the whole time I was training to be a comic illustrator is like deadlines are huge. Like, it is super important that you meet your dates. Your book has to come out on these days, especially if you're not doing like an indie comic or something like that, you know. And I was wanting to work for one of the big two, like Marvel or DC.
Sure.
So I really spent a lot of time like honing my foundational skills, and I would like time myself, and because I didn't want to like get the work and then not be able to produce it on time.
You know, you mentioned that you like working with acrylics. And one of the things that I've heard from a lot of artists who, you know, use acrylics and oil is they'll say they really love the speed that they can work with acrylic, but the vibrancy that they're able to get with oil, because acrylic will look great at first, but then once it dries, it desaturates a little bit and loses some of its fullness.
Yeah, definitely. I would totally agree with that. The vibrancy difference between oil and acrylic is huge. And that's because, you know, acrylic has a lot of different compositories of what's coming up with that color. In a lot of cases, oil paints are just two things. It's literally the pigment and the oil that's mixed into it. So like, that's why you end up getting such vibrant colors. But because it's not drying from just the water leaving it, it can take so much longer. A lot of times I'll work out something in acrylic and I'll put a base acrylic layer down and then paint oil over top of that. Because luckily with the way that acrylic works, you can do that. Obviously, maybe not particularly obviously, but you can't paint acrylic over oil.
Sure.
With the way that those things work. So yeah, it's the speed is such a huge thing for me. And I love being able to get through a piece. That I would say that's one of the bigger struggles I've actually had with diving into oil painting is I'm like, ooh, I love this vibrancy. And the moment you start to overwork something in oil, it gets really muddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then you actually start losing that vibrancy. That's the whole point of the painting. And you've seen in my studio.
Well,
in my studio.
But yeah.
Keep many projects going at the same time. And in my studio space, I usually have like 10 to 15 different paintings that are all in different stages of completion. And, you know, there's moments where, you know, I live in my studio. So like there's moments where I get up in the morning and I look around and I just look at all this work that I have to do. And I'm like, oh, I just need to work on this or work on that. And usually when I'm done with a piece, I try to get that piece out the door to either displayed somewhere or sold, because if it stays up long enough, I'll start picking it apart. There's multiple canvases that, you know, if you were to do like that X-ray thing that they do with those really old paintings, yeah, you would see like five or six completely different types of paintings underneath those, because I'm constantly picking my work apart.
You know, I've been to both kinds of artists. You know, I've interviewed artists who, one that jumps out in my head was John Kilmaster. And he has a lot of paintings that are out in the world. But he also has like a room full of paintings, and contrasting that to like Noel Weber. Or not Noel Weber, Fred Choate. Fred Choate, I went out to his place, and he has a few paintings around kind of in a gallery way, but you know, he's very much like, I finish a painting, I get rid of it, to the point where when I did a interview with him for my day job, he mentioned that there was like one particular painting that he made a little sentimental for himself that was one of the few that he actually ended up regretting selling, you know, maybe so quickly. So it's, I think for artists, especially like yourself, who are earning their living selling art, you know, it's important to continue selling the art. Having it around is a project state still.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. There's definitely a sentimental aspect that I've seen a lot of artists go through. And, you know, it's such an individual experience for each artist to like their creation process and what that means to them and the amount of themselves that they put into a piece. And, you know, I've seen, it's kind of like when you see someone get really sentimental about a car that they own, that they don't drive anymore or something like that. And, you know, someone comes by and gives them a good offer and they don't want to sell, or they'll give them an outrageous price. So they'll be like, hey, I'll have a painting that you really like and a reasonable price to sell it for is like $3,000 or something like that. And someone comes along and they offer you that. And I've seen artists that will go, Well, that's actually $10,000. And they know that that client doesn't have that revenue to buy that. And they just give it like, because it's emotionally been connected to them. And yeah, like that doesn't happen to me a huge amount. And I think that part of that was that I've seen myself as an illustrator much more than a fine artist initially, because it was always like, what does the client want? What can I create and make like the client happy with, and get that product out? You know, I've done a lot of portraits and pet portraits and like company designs and things along those lines. And same thing with, you know, the roots of trying to be like a comic illustrator is, okay, I'm going to get a script and the script is going to tell me what's going on in the story. And then I'm going to use my abilities as an artist to create this vision for this client or for the writer and send that out. And so that by default, I don't think really allows you to be as precious about your work. Like, you know that it has to go out. You know that it has to leave. It's not something that's going to be there for you. And when I create for myself, it grows with me. So that's why I think I end up painting over a lot of my paintings. Is I'll paint something and I'll like it and I'll put it up and I'll have it in my place. And then like a year later, I'm looking at it and I'm like, okay, I would do this completely differently. Or I start envisioning something different on that canvas space and I'll eventually end up painting over it. And I think that that's in some instances where the tortured artist aspect can come in. You know, I always am interested when I meet another artist who is very content with their work on a very consistent basis. I'm fascinated. I'm like, how do you reach that point? Because for me, I think it's a strong benefit in that I can see the growth in ability in composition and understanding how to do color, because I'm able to pick apart my own work. I'm able to recognize those flaws. And I don't see how that would be as easy to do if you're not seeing those flaws initially. But that, I also think that that has a lot to do with how you view your art. Like, we all view our art very differently. Sure. And mine's always trying to get better with lots of technical skills to make the images that are in my head come alive, like to be able to execute that. And I think there are some artists that just like allow it to be free and allow the canvas to do what it wants and like are more focused on emotion. And you can see that come out in pieces when people do that. And every once in a while, I try to do that with like oil paint in particular. I try to be much more free about how I go about doing things, because usually I'm a very precise technician. Mm-hmm. I definitely lean towards realism more than abstraction. But with oil paintings, I try to like purposely like let go a little bit with paint. It took me, you know, a while, even with acrylic paint, to really get into doing paintings, because like the brush stroke by default is not as accurate as the pencil stroke.
Sure. Well, and that's part of why I've never, aside from like doing collage type stuff, I hardly dabble in physical art. You know, most everything I do is through a computer in some way. You know, I like having that undo button. I like being able to infinitely fiddle, you know, change something. Say, I don't like that, go back and undo it. Sometimes though, it can be too much. And, you know, one of the first artists that I interviewed was Tilly Bubb. And she talked about how, I mentioned a comment similar to how, you know, sometimes I fiddle with things too much. And I keep and she was, you know, just kind of talking about how for her, she has to at some point accept that it's finished, you know? And I think that, I mean, obviously you are capable of finding a finish point at some point. But I think that for some people that can be a real stumbling block and prevent people from getting their their work out to the world. I know that for myself with Boise Art Scene, I didn't start it until after I had graduated from Boise State. I didn't start it until I had the microphones that I wanted and the camera that I wanted. You know, I didn't want to do it if I couldn't do it right or the way that I felt was right, you know?
Yeah.
And in some ways that could have been done it could have been done in a lesser way and still gotten the same reception, you know?
Oh, for sure.
But it's those personal standards, I think. But it definitely held me back in some ways to preventing me from producing stuff quickly. But in other ways, I think it creates a better product in the end. But
yeah,
art is so subjective, you know, and every artist is different. Some people can produce a masterpiece. And I mean, you look at something that Picasso did in his later years, they're not much more than a few lines.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're great works and stuff, but
I think all of us fall into that trap to a certain extent where you're wanting certain materials and you want to have the best products to put the best thing forward, because you look at what you admire and sometimes what inspires you to do those things, and you don't always see the lumps that person took to get there, and you just see the finished piece. And that's changed a little bit with social media. It seems like a lot of artists kind of let you into their process.
I think people want to see behind the scenes a little more, see some of the warts that are on there.
They definitely do. I've noticed that as I've tried to navigate that scene a little bit and market myself, if I'm giving people an inside view as to how I'm putting a piece together and the process associated with that, it seems to drive some more interest than just showing like the final, like, pretty picture. You know, I do digital art as well, and I've got a whole workstation that, you know, I've got like a $3,000 Wacom like Cintiq that's set up, and a lot of it was, you know, very much along the lines of what you're talking about, where, you know, I had a smaller digital workstation initially, and I was like, oh, if I could just get this piece of hardware and have this certain software, then I'm really going to be able to like do this digital work. Mm-hmm. And there was an excellent realization where I actually got those things. You know, I was fortunate enough to be able to set up and afford some of those products. And then I sat down and started to like work on my digital stuff initially. And it was not good. It was real bad. It was like, you know, like Etch-a-Sketch style, you know, and it always brings me back to this. I don't know if it's a parable or like if it actually happened, but I always thought it was a good example of this, is that there was a college art class where they basically ran an experiment, and it was all based around pottery. And they basically took half of the students and they said, you're going to work on one pot, and we want you to make that the most beautiful pot possible. And you have the whole semester to work on and complete that. And then they took the other half of the students and they said, you need to make 100 pots. Like the quality, like each pot doesn't need to be the most beautiful thing, but you need to make 100 in the course of this semester. That's what's required for you to, you know, pass or fail. And so they get to the end of the semester and everyone's presenting their work. And what they found was that the 50% of the class that did 100 pots, not only did they have 100 pots done, but the pots that they were doing at the end of that 100 were like an order of magnitude above the quality level of the other section of students that had the whole semester to do one pot. So I always try to keep those things in mind, like repetition, like get it out. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, like I probably could have gotten a really, really cheap tablet. There's lots of great options out there, and use like the cheapest free software or something like that, like a Procreate is a software that's like $10, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, I've got it.
Yeah, I use it. You know, I've got
an iPad. I saw enough artists using it that I got it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's a beautiful program. They just released Procreate Dreams, which is an animation program.
Okay.
And I've been playing around with that. That was another very strong influence for me when I was even younger, before comic books took in place, was animation. I wanted to be a Disney animator. And when I started to learn like what their daily work life was associated with, I was like, maybe instead of drawing the same image slightly different over and over and over and over again, I can do still story-based illustration through comic books. And that kind of seemed like a good pivot point. And especially since, you know, again, in the 90s, like there's so many comic artists that I really enjoyed their work. And it was always magic to watch them create these figures and pull these things from imagination and make these abstract things. So that's huge.
When you're not creating a commission, where do you get the inspiration for the pieces that you're making?
I would say it pulls back to my love of pop culture, graphic design, and illustration. So a lot of my personal works end up having a strong Art Nouveau look to it, as well as a like movie poster. Drew Struzan was a really big influence on me as well when I started doing more acrylic painting and found out about airbrushes. And that's a particular medium that's been interesting for me locally, because I don't know anybody else that uses an airbrush as much as I do to create their work. But I just remember seeing posters for like Goonies and Star Wars and like Back to the Future. You know, then I would go watch these movies and have these experiences with them, and they became correlated with each other. So just like when I was having these great experiences reading a comic book, I'm having these great experiences when I'm going to the movies and I associate these images with those. And so it makes me want to create something like that. Like when I'm creating for something that's pleasurable to me, I often find that it ends up being very similar to a lot of those images because they're very inspiring to me. And then Alphonse Mocha, I really enjoyed the way that he displayed the feminine body in his illustrative work, because it has this complex design element and you have all these intricate curves and, you know, circles and, you know, all in the background to like create this complexity. But then with the feminine body on front of it, it was often very simple, very basic with how he went about it. And it's always interesting that a lot of these illustrators and artists that really inspired me, a big part of their styles ended up being the restraints of the medium of work that they were getting. So like a lot of his work was being reproduced for advertisements and posters. And if you look at his like fine painting work in comparison to like his more popular illustrative work, they're like night and day. Like you can still tell that it's the same artist to a certain degree, but they're dramatically different. They're dramatically different. It's really, really cool to look at his fine art paintings and see the difference in that. And, you know, and even in mentioning that, like that's something that I find kind of common with myself too, where, you know, I'll do something digitally and then I'll do something traditionally. And if the person didn't know me, I don't know if they would particularly know that the same artist did both pieces of work. And because I've tried to make myself a jack of all trades to be as marketable for commissions as possible, I've tried to master as many styles as I possibly can. And then it's the accumulation of putting those all together that comes out in my personal work.
When I saw your coaster work that you had done with Noble, I in particular saw the Dune Sandworm one, and I was kind of struck by how similar in those in that series, your style was to nobles. I assume there was an intention in making some similarities with like the bold outlines and things like that.
Yeah.
Those were the notable to me, but I mean, like looking around your studio there, it's obviously, that's not your normal style.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that was a really fun experiment to do with Noble, you know, and getting to know him better. You know, there's some of the influences that we share, and the illustrative line, there's something about putting that around work that's just so satisfying. But in working in a much smaller space and a different medium, you know, I was doing a lot of that with acrylic and trying out these new Posca pens that are like acrylic paint pens. The composition had to be handled so differently, and the type of detail that I normally like to convey or the composition that I like to do, it had to be like reduced down a lot in order for it to be like readable. And it's actually something that I really struggled with. Like most of the pieces, I was like, ooh, I don't know. Let's see. But I enjoy that too, because I've really over a lifetime trained myself to be like a glutton for punishment, to not give up on things when they don't come out right. I go, oh, okay, what can I change this time? And what can I do this time? And me and Noble have talked, and we're probably going to do another one, another little week series with the Ghostbusters movie is going to come out soon. So we're going to do a whole series of Ghostbusters coasters, and I'm already planning it in a completely different way. So okay. It will be interesting to see how those things come out.
I'm a big Ghostbusters fan. So
yeah,
I look
such
forward
a good
to seeing how
and they've done a great job. I mean, even that newer one. I mean,
I haven't seen the newer ones, I'll admit. But
you haven't? Have you? Well, so the all female cast one, all those women in it were hilarious, and I just don't know if the writing was quite there.
Sure.
But the newer one that they did with the like the next generation of kids. That one was really good.
Okay.
Yeah, I would highly recommend it.
I'll
even
check it out.
As somebody that's a through and through, like Bill Murray, like hardcore Ghostbusters 1 and 2 fan.
Yeah.
I was pleasantly surprised with that one.
Okay.
So
yeah.
It's the nostalgia too. Like, you know, Big Trouble in Little Chinatown is this like quirky movie I grew up really loving. And like, I've had instances where I tried to show other people it that have never experienced it before. And they're like, that's a really quirky movie, man. I don't know. They don't love it as much as I do. And, but again, those things are such huge influences on my art, and the way that I like to produce works. I usually am very inspired by like figurative work and working on people, rather it's from pop culture or something from imagination. You know, I've always had a big pull in fantasy. Mm-hmm. You know, I read a lot of different fantasy books, and, you know, something about that mythical world is really fun to me. So I enjoy incorporating that into my work.
No, the piece that you mentioned or that you showed me that's on your workbench right now that you said you were streaming a bit. Oh, real quick before I talk about that, what's your, you said you stream on Twitch. What's your Twitch handle?
It's Danny Avery Arts with an S at the end there. For some reason, it didn't like just Danny Avery Art, which is what everything else for my like my website and Instagram handle is all Danny Avery Art.
Okay,
I try to make it easy, you know.
That's the way to do it, is to make it recognizable, easy to find. The painting that you said you've been streaming, it's kind of got that fantasy feel to it. It was horns on the character.
Yeah, she's got horns. Like, I was thinking somewhat of a druid-like lady, and I was thinking antlers or horns. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to create from that aspect. I do a lot of torso-type paintings and drawings. Like when I'm just sitting and doodling, that seems to come out of me very often. So the big thing with that particular aspect is I really wanted to show people the like step-by-step process of how I sit down with a page, and I initially will take like a light colored Prismacolor and I'll just draw it all out, and I'll get the composition where I want, and I'm not being overly finicky about where the lines are at, because I'm going to come in and a lot of those lines are just going to disappear into the painting. But I also tried to develop that world, like what kind of feel am I going for it? What environment would this person or creature be in? And yeah, that's been really fun on that level. And I kind of had this like Celtic feeling with it too. So I put some of that in there. And you know, a lot of times when I'm creating pieces like that, I'll put on music that's in that genre. So that really can influence your work, you know, and the way that you put down lines. It's very interesting how you think it's all very technique based on how you draw something realistic. But I find that if you're going to be drawing an aggressive action scene or, you know, some guy that's looking pretty aggressive and mean, if you put on aggressive and mean music, you kind of put those lines down a little harder, maybe you're a little more aggressive.
Sure.
You know, if you're drawing a feminine body and with like a flowing dress and a golden lit background kind of thing, if you put on very flowy music that's, you know, like got harps or something like that, it just really influences where you put like your light sources, especially when it's purely imagination.
Sure.
And you're not working from, you know, reference. So
yeah, well, one of the things that I've noticed on at least some of the commissions that I've seen around, specifically some of the pet things that I've seen, it seems like and I guess I saw it on some of the musician pieces that you've got up as well, it seems like your figure, your center focus has got a lot of detail to it. Like a lot of attention paid to the shading and things. And the one that I saw on your workbench doing in charcoal, the shading was excellent on it. It seems like you do a lot of neat abstraction around those as well. And I see it kind of come through in, I mean, most of your work, it kind of seems like it's got a central focused figure and then abstraction around it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's once again, that balance coming through of me like being confined within trying to create something realistic and create dimension to it. And then getting a moment to like give you relief from that. When you're looking at the picture, you know, you're taking in all these details and then it's going to like defocus you in a different way and look at like the emotion that's associated with what's around it. And then for me, that's kind of also like my decompression on the page. It's like, okay, you know, this is what a face looks like. There's a certain border within that that you can play with, and at least with the style that I like. I mean, obviously you can go very, very abstract and have it work for you. Picasso, like you mentioned earlier, sure. Fantastic example. But with the background, I don't want their eye to be pulled too much to the background, and I don't want to flatten the piece out. So I try to like create energy there so you have moments of relief with the reality of the figure that's pulling in. And I find that I really like doing those. That's a good observation.
Well, yeah, I mean, in photography, videography, you know, often you try to get a shallow depth of field, you know, you're trying to blur that background. You know, you have a nice sharp face or subject and a nice blurry background that doesn't distract from what's around there.
Right.
So I don't know if that's maybe why it stood out to me more, but it's a neat technique, I think, and it adds a really neat contrast, especially since you do such detailed work. I mean, not on everything, but on the ones that you're putting the detail into, it really comes through. And so it creates a nice contrast between the two.
Yeah. You know, I think that initially, when I was doing pieces like that, I was doing a very plain background, or maybe I would even, if it was like from a reference photo, work in some of the reference from the photo, you know, just have like trees in the background or whatever. And I was seeing that was making things, like that was dulling things out a lot. Like it was too generic. And that's what you don't want. You want something to be unique. And as soon as I was like, okay, I can experiment a little bit more, let me make this a little more interesting, is when I noticed pieces were coming out a little nicer and I was getting great responses from the clients in reference to those things. And the one thing that's nice about abstraction when it's used is people pick up very different things from it. you know, some things that you didn't even intend. They're like, oh, I see that you were intending to do this and you had this feeling associated with it. And then internally, there's like a blank stare of like, oh, I wasn't intending that at all. But then you go, okay, yeah, sure. And that's, I think that's one of the beautiful things about art, right? Is that we can all experience it so differently. You know, you can go in and look, one person looks at a painting and has an emotional experience and enjoys the texture and the abstraction associated with it. And another person looks at that and goes, I don't understand this. This doesn't like speak to me on any level.
Sure.
And those two people will have the exact opposite interaction with another painting where the other person that wasn't interested in sees something that like a river being painted, something pretty like realistic. And that speaks to them in a whole different way, where the person that enjoys the abstraction looks at the river and goes, yeah, that's okay. Like that, but that's not something I want to have in my house. And that's the beauty of the market that, you know, one thing I think that I've noticed over the last year in particular, and, you know, I've made a more prudent effort to get to know my peers in the area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, inevitably we always talk about how the market's going and
sure.
how we're selling things. And we've all noticed a pretty big difference, at least, you know, in the US over the last year. And like, there's this combination of like, okay, is the economy is a factor of it? What's being driven on social media and what gets attention? And then also like, there's this concern about AI art.
Sure.
You know, which is understandable to a certain point.
You talked about that a little bit in the last episode.
Yeah, I remember. Because a big part of what I used to do, like 50% digital stuff and 50% traditional stuff. So that it makes it easy for printing and all those kind of things. Mm. And, you know, we talked about the ability to go, to reverse and go back and redo things in digital art. Like, you don't have those little Bob Ross happy mistakes mm-hmm. kind of things. You can reverse it. You can have hundreds of different layers. And that's beautiful in its own way. But with like the AI art side of things, I think that we're going to see a mass production, and we already have to a point of very generic but beautiful art that
yeah.
doesn't have its own independent voice because it's pulling from such a wide range of different artists and accumulating that together, that I actually see it as an opportunity to like be an individual voice and create traditional pieces, because I think people are going to value something that's hand painted or hand drawn.
You're definitely not the first person I've heard say that sentiment.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people worry about how easy AI art will be, but uh-huh. it could increase the value of handmade things.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's important, and it's a muscle that I'm still learning to strengthen myself. You know, I have spent a lot of my career not marketing myself and working with private clients. And, you know, as I mentioned just a moment ago, as I've reached out to my peers and getting to know the local art community better and, you know, find out about you and everything.
Sure.
It's, you know, it's something that I put no effort into initially because I was getting enough private client work and people will be like, well, Danny, you've been here like your entire life and I've never heard of you. And you do like decent work. And I'm kind of surprised by that. And I, you know, had to really take that as good advice on things and go, okay, I need to start marketing myself. I need to get to know the community.
And a big part of this was I saw it as a win-win. You know,
I
would have people that I could talk to, artists
right.
That would create content for me
yeah.
or give me something to create content from.
Right.
And then also it would help a little bit at least to market or get a name out of people like yourself.
Yeah. I think that's huge. And it's such a great opportunity that's available. And I really dug, you know, listening to your podcast and going over things and the opportunity to have you come over and do this interview, you know, and looking at those things. I think we all need to take this creativity that we have in creating our artwork and putting pieces out there and apply it in a business sense and go, you know, what am I not actively pursuing? How many like companies have I reached out to ask them to do artwork? You know, it's like, okay, I'm going to be at this gallery and this will be in front of a certain amount of people that will come by it to come in the gallery work. But am I proactively reaching out to people and saying, hey, I would love to do a piece for you?
We talked a little bit about the idea of wanting the gear or the materials and stuff before getting going on things. And I, myself, in high school had an interest in video production and stuff like that. And then I moved to Idaho and I detoured. And then a decade later, I was like, you know, I want to do video again. But, and when I wanted to do it, you know, I started working at a TV station and it was really easy to get started at a TV station. But when I was a, you know, 18 year old, it seemed like a lofty thing. It's like, it's a TV station, but a lot of these opportunities are lower bars than people realize, you know, there might be a business that's looking for a graphic designer to come in and do something. And maybe they don't have a lot of money, but you know, there's a lot of merit in, I like to say that everything I know, I learned from messing things up.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to make bad videos before you can make good ones. You've got to make bad paintings before you can make good ones. Yeah. You've got to learn what works and what doesn't. And you have to make those mistakes before you can do the right things.
Definitely. You know, if you were to go back and talk to yourself when you were like at 18 and give yourself advice on like, you know, when that mindset was there where you were like, I need to have like this all set up to do that. What would you tell yourself?
I mean, I would just say, do it, you know, go for it, get your feet wet, you know? And I think that's good advice for anybody in any career, you know, whether you want to be an artist or a television person or an actor or, you know, nobody starts off at the top of their game. You know, another thing that's been in my head a couple of times as we've spoken is I think back to all the people that, quote unquote, don't get modern art or, you know, the classic example of going into a gallery and seeing a pure black canvas and going, well, I could have done that.
Yeah.
And I heard that explained one time as, yes, the artist has a black canvas in the gallery. You could do it. It's simple.
Yeah.
But it's who the artist is. It's their body of work prior to that that allowed them to have a black canvas in a gallery. You know, it's
and it's also, you know, do it. If you like, if you're like, okay, I could do that, then do it. And also think, you know, on those aspects, that artist just made you comment on their work.
It made you engage, made you think,
made
about
you go literally made you go there. Like, how many times, especially with how things are now, you know, I scroll through social media and and I see beautiful, beautiful, beautiful work all over the place. And, you know, fantastic artists. There's just an abundance of talent out there, which I think is awesome.
Absolutely.
You know, but how often do you stop and make a comment on something? How often do you verbally say something out loud about something or mention it to the person next to you? It's one of those clever things that when you take a moment and think about that just happened, you go, oh, you clever fella, or you clever lady. Like, I can't believe you made me like stop and have an interaction. That's like the whole point. Yeah. You figured out how to do that. And that's a really tricky thing to do.
A lot of people on social media, YouTube, things like that, they'll purposefully make a mistake or misstate something or mispronounce something, you know, and it's a way to get somebody to comment and go, you idiot, you did this wrong. And it's engagement. It feeds the algorithm. And it's a technique to it, you know, sometimes. Sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's not.
Sometimes it's not, yeah. And like sometimes, you know, there's positive, negative aspects to that. You know, I really enjoy Marcus Aurelius's Meditations. That's a fantastic Stoicism like diary. He didn't, to my understanding, he didn't ever intend it to be read as a book. It was just his personal notes to himself. And, you know, a big aspect of the way he looks at things is that, you know, remember that you will die. And at the end of the day, it's not going to matter to a certain extent. Like we worry so much about the thoughts of others and what we're going to accomplish in our life. And, you know, as we talked about the, like almost an imposter syndrome of wanting to make sure you have all the right tools or you're producing a certain quality of work before you actually put it out there and get other people to see it, because you're worried about someone going, oh, you're a fraud, or, oh, this isn't good work, or nobody buys the work. Mm. And when intrusive thoughts like that come into play, I always try to remember that, you know, in 100 years and 200 years, the likelihood that anyone's going to remember my work is pretty low. And even if they do, 9 times out of 10, they're going to remember the work itself. They might not even know that many personal details about me. They're certainly not going to be like, oh, he had this one painting at this one place that was, oof, it was atrocious. And even if they do, I'm not around anymore. Like, I have my personal experiences that you go through. So like, definitely, you just have to get out there and do it and not worry about it. And, you know, you take your lumps and, you know, laugh it off. And keep in mind that at the end of the day, like, are you going to be on your deathbed and going, oh man, I really wished that I had, you know, continued to watch the rest of that Netflix series instead of like putting my painting up that I never thought was good enough in a coffee shop or in a gallery. Like, you're not going to regret those things when you change your perspective.
Yeah, I think it's worth trying those experiences and putting those things out there and seeing what you can accomplish. You know, there's always people that are going to be unhappy with anything.
Yeah.
There's going to be somebody that's going to find fault in whatever you put out there.
All right.
So I think it's worth just doing it.
It is. You know? It is. Cause you're not, I don't think overall you're going to regret it. Like, it's so easy to see in hindsight that those things are not going to be as big of a deal as you think they are. And, you know, if you're being surrounded by a lot of naysayers, then, you know, it's a good idea to look at who you're surrounding yourself with and maybe start changing those things, you know, too.
What's next for you? How would you like your art to evolve?
So for me in particular, what I'm really focusing on in 2024 is going against how I've done things for the majority of my art career, which is I'm starting out with, you know, in Boise and in Idaho. I'm going to try to get work everywhere. I'm going to try to get eyes on my work. So I'm really going to be focusing on, you know, getting in more galleries and getting my work up and coffee shops and things like that. You know, I've already reached out to a lot of different businesses, you know, offering to do work at really reasonable rates, more because I just want the exposure. I want you to, you know, as you go around Boise, you're like, oh, there's Danny's work there and there's Danny's work there. Oh, that's definitely a big focus for me this year. And then, you know, further down the road, it's just going to continue to build on that and to, you know, expand that radius of where my work is at and the artists that I get to know. I love working with other artists too. You know, I find this to be true in a lot of occasions as I've gotten to know the local community, is that this job can be very isolating
Sure.
in a lot of ways. And a lot of artists get inspired by fellow artists. And so I think we all have this, like, or a lot of us have this pipe dream of, okay, like if we all go to a studio, we can go to, or we go to a communal place where there's three or four other artists that are working on things, and we can get in there and we can do our own work and be inspired by each other, and then, you know, create our work in a not completely isolated environment. Mm. So that's something that I'm also going to continue to strive and continue to try to be part of the community.
Nice. Yeah. One of the artists that I interviewed was in the past. Her name's Ace Zappa. She works in Garden City in kind of a communal. I don't know if she's still there, I assume, but she had a space that she was sharing it with at least two other artists. And they all are able to kind of bounce ideas. They weren't always all there at the same time,
Know?
So there was enough personal space, but also that ability to bounce ideas off other people. I've talked with the Sector 17 guys.
They're great.
You know, they work off of each other, and but they also work independently. And like Hawk will do oil paintings and like acrylic paintings and stuff. And I've seen on his Instagram around holiday times, he's done like spray like a house window with like the fake snow, and then like etch into it like a really cool scene or something.
Yeah, those guys are fantastic.
But I think that, you know, there's something to be said for that communal bouncing ideas off of others, having even just a basic review of your work. You know, for myself, working my day job, making videos, watching the way that other people edit their videos, you know, it's taught me new techniques. You know, I'm sure being around other painters, you know, you learn techniques.
For sure.
Nothing great. It happens in a vacuum, you know? I think that individuals can create great work, but I think that, again, if you're not creating, if you're not getting feedback, if you're not getting that loop somehow, you're not, it's hard to grow, hard to get better.
I agree. You can stagnate that way. We're designed to be social creatures. You know, how much social interaction you have can definitely vary between us all, right?
Absolutely.
But I totally agree with that. And I think that sometimes that can end up being a detriment to certain artists, is that they isolate to a point. And, you know, with it being such a mentally exhausting thing, you know, I think that's why we've seen in the past, like certain famous artists, like they just go down these deep holes, and it's because they're like avoiding those interactions. And sometimes that creates like fascinating, interesting work. But I'm kind of an advocate that they could have created just as fascinating, interesting work and like held on to their sanity and and things like that. But
well, you mentioned the thought of 200 years down the road, you know, who's going to remember things. And most people remember more about Van Gogh's cut ear than they remember his works.
Yeah. Branding. That's what it is, though. Like, you know, coming back to the marketing side of things a little bit, that artist has a brand.
Sure.
And then, you know, that makes it easily recognizable for, you know, his style is very, of course, recognizable as well and innovative. But, you know, there could have been somebody right next to him doing very, very similar work and doesn't get the attention because they don't have that branding associated with it. So that's something that, you know, again, coming back to the marketing side of things is, you know, I want my work to like speak for itself. And, you know, if you were to look at my social media profile, I don't know if there's any pictures other than like the picture of me on for like the icon. I don't think there's any pictures of me in my work. And it's because I want like people to enjoy the art and I want that to influence it. But that is another big aspect of, you know, why people buy art too, is like, this artist is this and lives this way and getting to know themselves. So it's an interesting part of it.
So is there anything that you'd like to say that I haven't touched on or haven't asked you about?
You know, no, I think we've been pretty thorough with the interview. The only thing I would say is that, you know, if you're a fellow artist or if you're someone that's interested in becoming an artist, like, I'm an open book. Like, reach out to me. I'd love to talk to you. I'd love to have a conversation, or see your work, or, like, you know, building that great community is something that I'm so open to, and sharing, like, ways that we can be creative in marketing our work and keeping art out there, because I think it's so important. You know, when we look at some of the social issues that we're running into, and, you know, how a lot of us are feeling more isolated than ever, especially since the pandemic, art plays a huge role in helping balance our culture. You know, we have the economy and having, you know, a good job and your family aspect. And the people that understand it, I think, pick up on it big, but some people that don't realize how much having a moment for that relief in your life. You know, I talked about having relief in my paintings, where you're looking at this focus and then you have a moment where you can kind of give your eye a break or relax a little bit. Like, art does that emotionally for us in our day-to-day lives. You know, rather that's a movie that you're going to see or a painting that you're going to view. So I think it's really important that we all support that creative process and, you know, be more avid about trying to get that aspect into our life. Just like, you know, keeping exercise in your life and eating the right foods, like, you need to ingest the, you know, good art to help balance your life.
Do you think that art is something that you'll keep doing?
Yes. Yeah. Even as a toddler, you know, I was playing in the funnies and I enjoyed having paint and ink all over myself. And that's always been the case. Like, there's usually not a day where there's not paint somewhere weird on me. Like, I get it on my back somehow. Like, I don't even know, understand how that happened. Yeah. So it is one of those careers that, you know, if I'm lucky enough to continue to do it full time my entire life, I don't think that I would ever retire from it. So yes, I totally plan on doing it forever in one form or another.
Excellent. Well, Danny Avery, thank you so much for joining me today and talking with me. I appreciate you taking that time.
Yeah, Morgan, it's been a pleasure, man. I really, really enjoyed the conversation.
That's great. Well, thank you for listening to the Boise Art Scene Podcast. I'm the host, Morgan McCullum. Social media is done by Katie Kloppenberg. And be sure to subscribe on your favorite platform.